Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, July 1st. I'm Ray Graff. Once again, we talk astronomy with Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. Dr. Rapson earned her PhD in astrophysical sciences and technology from RIT. She is a professor at SUNY Oneonta. You know Bob Berman. He's one of the most widely read astronomers in the whole wide world. And we welcome your calls if you have an astronomy question, whether it be black holes or white dwarfs or something that's beige out there. 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551 is our number. You can also email your astronomy questions to voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org. But again, that number is 800-348-2551. Astronomy, your calls coming up. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we talk astronomy, and we welcome back Dr. Valerie Rapson. Dr. Rapson earned her PhD in astrophysical sciences and technology from RIT. Her research focused on the structure and composition of planet-forming disks around nearby young stars. Dr. Rapson spent 5 years developing and teaching astronomy education programs for the Dudley Observatory and is now an assistant professor in the Physics and Astronomy Department at SUNY Oneonta. Much to talk about in the world of astronomy today, and we hope you join us. 800-348-2551 is the number, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. I am watching the email feed come in, so if you got one, maybe I'll see it and we'll read it. 800-348-2551 is the sure bet. That's our phone number. Dr. Valerie Rapson, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Always great to be here.
How is the summer going so far?
Oh, it's going great. It's super busy, but a lot of fun. I've got three awesome summer students that are working with me. They're working on planetarium shows. They're observing novas in the sky. It's been a blast.
What nova?
So there's a new nova in Hercules that's almost naked eye visible, and we haven't checked recently, but you might even be able to see it with just your eyes now. But this star has gotten many magnitudes brighter than it was just a few weeks ago, and my students have observed it at least twice now. So we're working on analyzing the data and figuring out exactly how bright it is now.
Wow. Now, is this one that... You know, assuming I could find Hercules up there, if I had a good pair of binoculars, would I be able to see that?
Oh, definitely.
Really?
Yeah, it's like magnitude 6.4 last reported, and it might be even brighter now. So binoculars will do it without a problem.
That's very exciting. And Hercules is in what part of the sky in the evening?
Yeah, so it's going to be in the south, right next to the summer triangle. If you can find that huge triangle, you want to look just to the right of it, and you'll be able to see Hercules.
Well, that's
there.
Pretty exciting. When did they first spot this nova? Not your students, but scientists
yeah,
in general.
Yeah, well, you know, we knew about this nova. We knew that it varied periodically, but a couple of weeks ago, literally, it just got so much brighter all of a sudden, and we're not sure why. So they've asked the public and students and anybody who's got a telescope to look at this thing and help the scientists figure out what's going on.
I mean, do they have any theories as to why it brightens and then dims and brightens?
Right. Well, I mean, it depends on what kind of nova it ends up being, you know, whether it's got a binary companion and material gets dumped on it, or whether this is just, you know, an older star that's naturally releasing some material. We don't know the details.
That's pretty exciting. All right. Well, Valerie Rapson joins us today. It's astronomy, and I get excited about this stuff because I have followed this since I was a little kid, and that was hundreds of years ago. Gravitational waves have been a thing. I think Einstein talked about them, and they were proven not too long ago, and now they're in the news again.
Yeah. So people have probably heard of, you know, LIGO and Virgo. They've been looking for these gravitational waves. They detected them a few years ago. And now they've confirmed two neutron star black hole pairs. They're separate, and they came in like 10 days apart, just randomly. And the data matches this neutron star black hole pair for the first time.
You know, it's funny. The news feed, we get the Associated Press news feed, and most newscasters and reporters or whatever, they're not clued in like you are on the science of the heavens.
Right.
But we did get this story, and I actually read it earlier this week. It was talking about the black hole swallowing a neutron star. And this was apparently the first time they've observed sort of that happening. Why was that a big deal?
Right. So it's the first time they've confidently seen this happen, and they also didn't see any light signatures with it. So neutron stars are the cores of dead stars. They still emit light, but this happened so fast, both of them, that the black hole literally swallowed the neutron star, and they didn't see any light in X-rays, visible wavelengths, nothing come from this source.
Very cool. Our number here, by the way, if you have an astronomy question, is 800-348-2551. Dr. Valerie Rapson joins us today. You sent me a link from Science News. This moon-sized white dwarf is the smallest ever found. The dead star is also spinning extremely fast and has a powerful magnetic field. Now, explain to our listeners what a white dwarf is, and they all spin, though, right?
Right. They all spin, but this one's spinning fast, which suggests that it might actually be a collision between two white dwarfs. So what a white dwarf is when you have a sun like our star or a little bit bigger, when they end their life, they release most of their gases, they create a planetary nebula, and their core shrinks down to about Earth-sized and becomes a white dwarf. It's just the leftover bits of the inside of the star.
Yeah.
Well, this one is particularly small. It's only about the size of the moon, so about a quarter of the size of a normal white dwarf. But it's really massive. It's about 1.4 times the mass of the sun, which is right on the border of being able to survive as a white dwarf.
Yeah.
And it looks like, based on its rotation rate and its size, the two smaller white dwarfs probably merged and created this new, small, rapidly rotating white dwarf.
Is this something that has never been seen before?
Not to my knowledge. We've never seen one this small that suggests that they merge together. And it's cool because when we think of collisions in outer space, we think of stars smashing into each other and exploding. But for this, we have to remember they're plasmas, and they can just kind of merge together into this one new interesting object that we've never seen before.
The fact that it has a very powerful magnetic field, what does that tell you, or what does that indicate?
Right. Well, that indicates, again, that merger there. And that fast rotation rate, when you take a lot of mass and you put it together into a white dwarf, it actually gets smaller. It's kind of counterintuitive from normal objects. You know, normally if I gain mass, I'm going to get bigger. But if a white dwarf gets mass, it's going to get smaller, which is going to increase its rotation rate. So all of this, the magnetic field, the rotation, the visible light that we see, is all indicative of this merger.
Very exciting. And now you also had some bad news. I don't know if it's bad news. There has been trouble before with the Hubble, if you go way back when, in the beginning.
Yeah.
But there's some computer trouble up there.
Yeah. So last I saw, Hubble's been down for almost 2 weeks now. And what happened was the payload computer, the computer that controls the instruments, talks to the memory on board, stopped working a few weeks ago. And it put all the instruments in like a safe mode. And they've tried multiple things to get the computer back online, but it won't read and write from the memory banks. So a couple of days ago, they tried to turn on the backup computer, which was installed in 2007. And they got the same errors, which is both good and bad. It's good in a sense that it means that it's not the computers that are broken, it's something else. But it's bad in that, you know, Hubble still isn't working at the moment. So the engineers have some more work to do.
And this brings up one of the things Bob Berman has talked about when he has been critical of the Webb telescope. And that's going out to not geosynchronous orbit, but way out there, like beyond that, right?
Yeah.
Like a million miles out?
Yeah, it's going to the L2 point, so further away from Earth. And it's not going to be serviceable.
Right.
If
with
something
the Hubble,
is breaking, we're not going to fix it.
Theoretically, somebody could go out there.
Because we don't have the shuttle anymore, we don't have the appropriate type of craft to send a human up to fix it. But if we really wanted to, we could, you know, build something that would allow us to do that. So they don't plan to fix it if it does turn out to be totally broken, but I think they're on the verge of figuring out what's going on.
Our guest today is Dr. Valerie Rapson. It's Astronomy Today. 800-348-2551 is our number. Let's grab one call. We'll take a break, hit the email bag, and then hit the phones once again. Tony's in Schenectady. Tony, you're on.
Yeah, what's up, Valerie?
Oh, boy.
Objects in the sky. But the problem is that my hands shake.
Yeah.
And it makes it really tough to view things when my hands are shaking.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And so I figured I could probably get a tripod. But the problem with that is that I'm like 6'8". I'm really tall.
Yeah.
And I don't want to have to be scrunching over in order to look through my binoculars.
Right.
Do you have any suggestions?
Right. I do have a very simple suggestion that people sometimes don't think about. just sit at a table or stand on a deck and rest your elbows on the table or the deck and use that as your tripod while you're looking.
Yeah.
Just find somewhere that you can stabilize yourself and you'll be able to use the binoculars far better. Because I even have trouble standing there and trying to look at the sky through them. That's my best suggestion.
Tony, it sounds like you are a million miles from Earth. What is going on with your connection, sir? You all right?
I don't know. There's something wrong with my phone.
Yes. Yes, there is. Well, anyway, so you're 6'8". You're almost in space as it is. So I think you should just look up, right?
Yeah. I hear these jokes all the time.
I'm sorry.
I bet.
Sorry, Tony. Hey, thanks for the call. We're going to take a break. 800-348-2551 is our number. 800-348-2551. And the email address is voxpop@wamc.org. We have several emails we'll get to in a moment. And we'll get to more of your calls coming up with Valerie Rapson. Long before our guest Valerie Rapson was born, there were these guitar players, Jimmy Page and Jeff Beck. And that's Beck's Bolero, 800-348-2551. Not a music show. This is a talk show, and it's a call-in show. Please call us. We're talking about astronomy today. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. And Dr. Rapson, this one came in from Jay. Jay says, is there any way of mathematically calculating the chances of, probability of, life elsewhere in the universe? Are the chances of life getting better with more understanding of exoplanets?
So the short answer is yes, we can try. We can use this thing called the Drake equation, which gets us thinking about all the variables we need for the possibility of life. You know, do we have enough stars? Do those stars have Earth-like planets? Are they habitable for life? Do the aliens want to talk to us? These are all the things that are included in this equation, but they're really just educated guesses at the moment. The only thing we have a rough idea of is the star formation rate of our galaxy, but beyond that, all of our other guesses are just educated guesses based on our own solar system. So that really gets us thinking mostly about aliens in our own galaxy. If we want to go beyond that, we really need a lot more knowledge. But the more we study these exoplanets, especially if we find Earth-like ones, I think we'll be able to hone in on some of these numbers and get a much better sense of aliens and the possibility of them.
But until we find one living thing anywhere other than here, I mean, who's to say that those who would say we are alone in the universe aren't correct?
Yeah, exactly. You know, we have to have some strong evidence that suggests otherwise. And we can be optimistic, we can be pessimistic, whatever your preference is. But you're right. Until we have strong evidence one way or the other, we just don't know.
This one's from Daniel. Daniel says, do we feel the large-scale effect of the Milky Way's magnetic field? Not the disk's magnetic field specifically, but the entire Milky Way's magnetic field.
So we are such a small thing inside of the whole galaxy that the things like, you know, galactic magnetic fields and fields of other objects really don't affect us in a strong way. And a lot of the magnetic fields are generated at the core center of the galaxy, you know, wherever the central gravitational source is. And the further away you get from that, the less you feel it. So we are plenty far away to really be influenced by any of that kind of stuff.
All right, this one's from Steve. Dr. Valerie Rapson is our guest. And by the way, the phone lines, still a few lines open, 800-348-2551. We'll be getting to the lines in a moment. Steve writes, this is a bit more of a physics question.
Okay.
Could you speak about the fascinating phenomenon of particle entanglement? Well, we only have 40 minutes to go, 45.
That's a whole, you know, quantum physics lesson here. But, you know, the basic idea is that on a quantum scale, on a really small scale, it is possible for particles to be entangled such that their information remains connected. So when you influence one particle, you also have an effect on the other particle, even if they're not physically touching or connected in some way.
Right.
That's about as much as as I understand about it. The rest of it is just crazy math that's way over my head. But maybe someday we'll know more.
You're a PhD.
Yeah, but not in everything. I know a lot of stuff, but not everything.
And so far, you're doing all right. All right. This was actually forwarded from Roundtable producer Sarah LaDuke. Okay. This email went to a different email address. Mm. But because we have very conscientious people here, it was sent to Vox Pop. And this one is from Frank. Frank says, details about the giant comet Bernstein heading our way.
Yeah. So this comet is huge. It's like 125 miles wide or
what?
Something. Yeah, it's massive, but it's really far away. And we got super lucky because it's so large. It's bright enough for some of our large telescopes to pick up. But it's tremendously far away. And I think the year was 2031 that it will truly, you know, enter our solar system. I think it's going to pass by Saturn about 2031. So we've got some time before we need to, like, worry about it. But
should we be
huge.
Worried about it?
Not with the current orbital trajectories that they have projected. I mean, things can change, right? Everything moves, gravity influences things. So things might change. But right now, it is not on a collision course with Earth. But it's like the biggest comet we've ever detected so early in its orbit in the solar system.
This is exciting. Dr. Valerie Rapson joins us here. You know, I forget the name of the comet, Schumacher-Levy or whatever.
Yeah.
It went into Jupiter, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that was quite a show.
Yeah, definitely. That one was huge. It crashed into Jupiter. You know, we don't want to experience that on Earth again.
That would not be a good idea.
No.
This one from Susan. We'll get to the phone shortly. 800-348-2551. Susan writes, we saw the strawberry moon the other day, and it looked at it with our binoculars. We saw these starbursts on the surface of the moon. Any ideas what they are?
Oh, starbursts on the surface of the moon. That's
you know what?
Interesting.
She's not alone. I mean, not necessarily this time, but
that
has been reported over the years for decades and decades.
Really?
Yeah, by astronomers.
Wow. No, I honestly have never seen that, and I'm not sure what it is. You know, it makes me suggest that, you know, if you're looking at it with binoculars or a small telescope, maybe you're getting some light reflections from on Earth that are kind of leaking in and making it look like it's sparkling up there. There's nothing that you would expect to be able to see on the moon. You know, maybe the sun is reflecting off craters in a weird way, but I feel like that effect would be too small to really see with small equipment. So,
Very interesting. Valerie Rapson joins us. Now to the phones we go. 800-348-2551. Mike in Wilbraham. Mike, you're on.
Oh, hi. How you doing?
No, I'm doing all right. How are you?
Good. I got a question for her. A couple weeks ago, we have a station on our TV. It's called the NASA Channel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Channel.
Sure.
And there was a lady on there a couple of weeks ago, and she was talking about exploring Mars.
Hmm.
And she stated that the United States has an agreement with other countries not to explore a certain part of Mars.
Huh.
And she didn't say why, but I was wondering if you knew why.
I've not heard that.
I have not heard that either. That sounds kind of strange to me. I mean, we have agreements that, you know, no one country can own any part of space. You know, at the moment, you can't claim property on Mars or the moon or anything like that. But I have never heard of an agreement that allows somebody not to go check out a certain portion of Mars. I mean, we've got satellites orbiting Mars right now that have mapped the entire thing. So there's nothing that we have avoided on purpose.
I know. It just struck me as odd that that's what she said. I mean, and she did say it. I did hear it. And I was just wondering why that would be. Maybe they see something. They said, nobody go there. I don't know.
Interesting.
I just wonder if you heard anything about it.
Now, you sure you had the NASA channel on? Because, I mean, I see a lot
yes,
of weird
did,
stuff.
Yeah.
I've not seen this.
No, it wasn't one
this.
Of those weirdo channels.
No, and I like those weirdo channels, but I have never heard that particular.
I will have to look it up.
I didn't either. I've never heard that. But she said that the United States has an agreement with other countries not to explore a certain part, and I was just wondering if you caught on to that.
I have never heard that, but after this show, I'm definitely going to look it up because now I'm intrigued.
Okay, fair enough. Mike, thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. That's voxpop, vox. Some people write in box pop or box top. It's vox pop, Latin, vox populi is what it really is. Vox pop, wamc.org. Our guest today is Dr. Valerie Rapson. It's astronomy. And Jerry's in Montague. Jerry.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Can you hear me okay?
You betcha.
Oh, good. Thank you so much. Well, my question, I think his name was Tony. I might be wrong. He had a question about being tall, like 6'8", and shaking. And I just had a suggestion. You know, they have those kind of slings for your back, almost like a figure eight or something. You could put your elbows in it to rest your elbows. It could be cloth or something, but I'm sure they have it commercially as well. But anyway, I just saw that. And besides that, oh my gosh, I love this topic, science and space.
Yeah.
Just love it.
Nice. Awesome.
I love it too. Jerry, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it. You know, it occurs to me, if you're using binoculars, and I've never tried this, if you lie down and then rest your elbows at your side, wouldn't that work?
That might help, yeah. Yeah, definitely. It might be a little tricky to figure out exactly where you're looking because you're so used to trying to orient standing up. But
No,
that would definitely help stabilize your body a little bit.
We're joined today by astronomer Dr. Valerie Rapson, and our number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Now, at Oneonta, where you are, you said now, I've never seen this. I've been through the town and checked out the school, but I have not seen this. You have a telescope farm somewhere out there?
We do. We have an observatory at College Camp. It's about 1.5-2 miles north of campus. There's beautiful trails there. Anybody is welcome at any time. But if you go up there, you'll see these like white domes, and that's where all of our telescopes are. And we have the largest telescope in New York State. We have a 40-inch telescope, and it's actually on wheels. We hook it up to a four-wheeler, and we roll it out when we want to use it. And one of the things that the summer students are going to do with me is help me figure out how to use it, because I've never used one like that before. So we're going to work together and figure out how to get it functional.
Well, what sort of challenges will a large telescope like that
face that it's on wheels is problem number one, right? Normally, when you have a big telescope, it's permanently mounted. It's aligned to the sky properly. So we have to literally wheel it out of the shed, and we have to make sure that it is aligned in such a way that when we go to track the stars, it's going to track them accurately. So there's a lot of extra calibration that you have to do before you can use it for science. But aside from that, you know, having a large telescope lets you see, you know, galaxies and other faint objects that you wouldn't normally be able to see with a standard telescope.
We're joined today by Dr. Valerie Rapson. It's Astronomy Today on Vox Pop. The number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. When did you, as a little kid, realize, oh, the stars, they're calling me? What year? How old were you?
Yeah, so I've watched Star Trek since I was a baby. You know, my dad tells me, like, in the womb, I was already watching Star Trek.
Right.
So that really influenced me a lot. And my dad and I used to deliver newspapers overnight, and we used to listen to Art Bell's radio show overnight.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and
Coast to coast.
Yeah, so he had all those people calling in, asking those crazy questions. And I remember I always told my dad, you know, I'm going to go to MIT someday and be an astrophysicist and figure this out. Like, I had to know, are there other creatures out there? What are the stars doing? Do black holes exist? You know, and that's really what sparked my interest. And then, you know, I took a more practical route rather than being an alien hunter. But
interesting. Now, you know, I'm so glad you brought that up, because in your mingling, I'm sure you astronomers have cocktail parties. In your mingling, do you think that most astronomers, when they were young, wanted just to find out if there was life out there? Is that the primary question?
You know, I think so. And I think many of them are believers, because it just seems so impractical that there's so many stars and planets out there and that we're the only creatures here. I think a lot of them, you know, were influenced by sci-fi and also just influenced by looking at the stars and wondering, what are those twinkling lights in the sky?
Yeah.
You know, because historically they thought it was just twinkly lights. They didn't think there was anything to it. But now we know so much more about the science, and it's just fascinating.
What, you know, to show you how the ancients thought of things, or maybe it wasn't even the ancients. A buddy of mine, 30 years ago, said, oh, no, the moon is very small and only 10 miles away. Oh. This is within our lifetimes.
Right.
But I mean, you know, what did the Romans think? There were lights hanging from the firmament?
They thought that there was just some ether that literally held the stars in place. They were all the same distance away, and I guess they were just there for us to look at. I don't know.
All right, let's go back to the phones, 800-348-2551. Ken is in Albany. Ken, you're on.
Hello there. Dr. Rapson, I have a question about magnetic fields around, say, like, small objects like white dwarfs or neutron stars.
Sure.
If I understand it correctly, a rapidly spinning stellar remnant like that can have its magnetic field wrapped up around it as it spins. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
I'm just wondering about the physics of that. I mean, there's magnetic flux isn't really a physical thing. It's a field.
Right, right.
I'm wondering why it would be able to be bent by physical spinning of its source.
Yeah, so it all has to do with the fact that the field is embedded in the plasma that makes up these objects. So we think of magnetic fields as like a solid bar magnet that generates a magnetic field.
Yeah.
But these magnetic fields are coupled to the plasma. So as the plasma moves, the spot where the field is generated and flowing is constantly moving, and that allows it to wrap around the star, create, you know, funnels and jets out the poles of the star. So it all has to do with how the field is coupled to the object, which is not a solid object.
The plasma. In my feeble brain, I'm trying to figure out what, if there's some sort of, well, I know there isn't, but it almost seems like there's a drag on the flux lines themselves them to be slowed down the further out they are from the source.
Yeah. I mean, like we said, it definitely does influence the strength of the magnetic field and how they twist around. I mean, we see this with the sun, and we see it with the small objects as well. And the sun actually, you know, after a certain amount of time, the field flips because the magnetic field gets twisted up so much that it literally strains and has to flip to essentially reset itself.
Ken, thanks a lot. And the Earth is doing that as well, right?
Right. So the Earth has its own magnetic field. The process is different. We think that there's molten iron moving in the core that's generating the magnetic field. So it's a little bit different. Our magnetic field is much more stable than that of a white dwarf's or a star's.
One of the things I worry about, and there are many things that I worry about, is that the Earth's magnetic field will disappear. And and you see it waning at times, and they say, okay, well, that is probably because the poles are going to flip at some point.
Right, right.
You just said, we think that the Earth's core is molten iron. And so this, again, brings back my fears. We're not exactly sure, right?
No, well, you know, this field of magnetohydrodynamics is a very broad one that we don't fully understand yet. You know, we can obviously see the magnetic field of our Earth and the sun, but all of the physics that goes into it from the large scale down to the quantum scale, we don't have it fully fleshed out yet. So we're taking our best guesses as to how and why these fields are generated and how they're going to move with time, but we don't fully have an explanation yet.
Now, we know Mars, or we believe from looking at rocks, that Mars had a substantial magnetic field at one time. It does not now.
Correct. Yep.
They say, well, Mars is much smaller than the Earth. We don't have to worry about it. I worry about it. What about other rocky planets in our solar system?
Yeah. So we are the one with the strong magnetic field. I think Venus has a little bit of magnetic field, too, if I'm remembering. But basically, the smaller you are, the faster you're going to cool off and the quicker you're going to lose your magnetic field, because you have to have molten conductive material inside the core to have the magnetic field. So we are the one with the strong magnetic field.
So should I worry or not?
I don't think so. I mean, we can look at the magnetic field records, you know, hundreds of millions of years in the past, and we know it's been here for a long time. It's not going to just stop tomorrow. It might flip, and that'll be interesting to see. You know, it hasn't flipped on a modern human time scale, so we don't really know exactly what's going to happen at that moment, but it's not like every flip has caused a mass extinction or something, so you shouldn't be too worried about it.
All right, I'll try to calm down. Our guest today is Valerie Rapson. It's Astronomy Today, 800-348-2551. If you have a question, 800-348-2551. Matt is in Coxsackie. Matt.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
The guy that wrote The Martian came out with a new book, and he spoke about traveling at light speed and the theory of relativity.
Sure.
And he said that the faster you go, the closer the object you're traveling to would appear. And if you slowed down, the object would suddenly appear farther away. And that didn't make sense to me. If you're at a certain point in space, wouldn't it just remain?
Well, you would think that under normal mathematics, but in special relativity, no. So what he's talking about is length contraction. When you're moving close to the speed of light, distances between you and the object in front of you literally shrink. You can travel further distances in less time. But it all is dependent on how fast you are moving relative to everything else. And if you slow down, those distances are going to change. And, you know, if you slow down to a stop, they change back to what we experience as normal. So you will make some progress towards the object, but the current measurement of how far away it is will change based on your speed.
Huh. It still boggles my mind.
I agree, man. I'm totally
with you,
man.
It hurts all of our
man.
Brains.
Well, if you want to follow up, go ahead. Otherwise, I'm going to go get a drink of water.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Thank
you. Thanks for the call. Valerie Rapson joins us today. 800-348-2551 is the number. If you have an astronomy question, 800-348-2551. Email voxpop@wamc.org, and we will be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC. It's Astronomy Today with Dr. Valerie Rapson. Ray Graff here, and your number to call is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Val, I covet your water bottle. That is really cool.
Yeah. It's got a picture of the Voyager spacecraft on it, because back when I was at the Dudley, we did a film screening of The Farthest, the PBS special about Voyager.
Yeah.
And they sent us all water bottles, and I really love this.
There's
bottle.
A collector's item, and you better keep close eye on it for the next 20 minutes. Hey, how'd the TV thing go?
It went great. It was so much fun. So I filmed a pilot episode for The Great Courses, and hopefully I'll be contracted to film a whole series. But it's all about observational astronomy and how the general public, literally anybody with a computer and a telescope, can help contribute to real science. You know, take pictures and analyze them in a way that can help the scientists out there.
Well, that's very exciting. And so hopefully you get that call. You have an agent, I assume.
I hope so. Yeah. They're looking into it, and I'm just waiting for them to review the pilot. And if all goes well, they said that they'll likely release the pilot at the end of the summer so all the viewers can watch. And then in a couple of years, we'll have a full series.
Well, when that pilot airs, send us the link and we'll put it on our page.
That would be awesome. Yeah, Thank you.
All right, this one is from Larry. Larry writes, more dumb questions. Larry, again and again, we say there are no dumb questions, only... I'm not going to go there. All right, Larry. Larry writes, is it possible that time-space itself has mass and therefore gravity and could exert influence and account for the missing dark matter? What do we call the force that propels the Big Bang and the expansion of space? Dark energy? And that is from Larry. Larry, that was not a dumb question.
No.
Neither one of them were dumb.
No, those are great questions. So with the dark matter question, you know, they're kind of separate questions. We're still trying to figure it out. Right. We're still trying to figure out what this dark matter is. Obviously, it has mass. It is influencing things with gravity and we can't explain it. It could be, you know, embedded in space-time somehow, or it could just be more like natural matter that we just haven't figured out yet. That is still a mystery. We don't know the answer to that. But his dark energy question there, well, I guess the answer is dark energy. That is what is accelerating the expansion of the universe. And that is also unexplained, too. Nobody knows what it is.
Is that proven, though?
Well, we know for sure that the universe is accelerating. We know less about dark energy than we know about dark matter. So we know that dark energy or something is accelerating the universe, but what exactly it is and how it works is a big mystery still.
Very interesting. And I guess it's predicated upon the fact or the not fact that Einstein got it right and that all of these laws, these gravitational laws, are uniform, right?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if they act differently at a great distance, then we don't need dark energy, right?
Right. So yeah, that's one of the kind of the alternative theories is, do we basically take Einstein's math and kind of keep it and assume that it holds on great distances and great scales, or do we have to adjust the mathematics to help explain this? And maybe we don't need a true dark energy force. Maybe we just have to alter the math a little bit, much like Einstein altered the math a little bit to explain some other things.
I guess he was allowed. Our number here is 800-348-2551. If you have a question for Valerie Rapp, perhaps, and soon-to-be major television star, Fred in Gilderland. Fred, you're on.
Hi, thank you much for taking my call.
You bet.
I can understand that in the sun's apogee, the height that it gets every day compared to the day before changes, and it changes just a little bit because of the tilt of the Earth's axis.
Mm-hmm.
But the moon, is it my imagination, or can the apogee of the moon change quite a bit from one day to the next?
Yeah, so the position of the moon changes for the same reason. So Earth is tilted relative to the sun and relative to the orbit of the moon. So depending on where the moon is in its orbit and where the Earth is around the sun and the lighting and everything, it all works together. And it does change the height of the moon in the sky as well as slightly the size of the moon in the sky.
I think I got that.
It all has to do with the orbits
and
how they're tilted and relative to one another. It's hard to describe it without, you know, balls and demonstrations and pictures to show you. But the answer is yes, the heights can change for the moon and the sun.
By the way, Fred, you could watch this online at WAMC.org, and then we have a video feed, and you can see that Valerie is waving her arms around.
I know no one could see me, but I feel like I'm helping here.
Yeah, it was helping me, but I still don't get it because I'm in radio. Hey, Fred, thanks a lot for the call. We go to Mike in Fishkill. Mike.
Hey.
Hey.
How are you?
Oh, pretty well. And yourself?
I'm doing well on this Thursday. So my question is, what is the simplified definition of matter?
Ooh, I like.
That's deep.
I love it.
Well, the way I explain matter, which maybe isn't the most scientifically correct answer, is just the material that makes up everything and the energy that is associated with the material around us. You know, we think of matter as physical stuff that is, you know, of a similar size to us. But of course, matter is really just a collection of particles and energies of particles that create everything around us. So that's how I think
gotcha.
Of it. I'm sure there's, you know, a much more deeper, scientific, better way to explain it. But that's how I try and explain it in the simplest terms.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Is it true that if you were to really drill down and magnify the human body, there'd mm-hmm. be more space in there than actual stuff?
Yeah. When you get down to the atomic scale, there's so much space between the nucleus and the electrons, and there's space between the quarks and the nucleus. It's just, yeah, there's a lot of space in there.
I mean, is matter even a thing, or is it all energy?
Well, matter is kind of a formulation of energy, maybe, as a way to think about it.
But I mean, because I hear that atoms, as we think of them, when they got a nucleus and electrons flying around and whatever, the diagrams we see, they're just representation of fields.
Right.
So is there anything real? Is there? I mean, I could hit this desk.
Right,
and
right.
It
and
feels
your
real to me.
Mm-hmm.
But is it anything other than energy?
Well, I mean, it is real in a sense that it creates forces that we feel. So we perceive it as real. You know, it's solid because the atoms are held tightly together and they are creating this, you know, force that pushes against you knocking on the table. So it is real in that sense. But you're right. You know, the atoms have electron clouds and quantum mechanics says, you know, we can never really know where anything is on these small scales. It's all in this kind of, you know, ether that we can't really, you know, pinpoint.
Doesn't that make you queasy or
uneasy? I just
uneasy.
Don't think about it.
Okay. And you,
then I feel better.
At the beginning of the show, before the show started, you and I were talking about looking at the stars.
Right.
And you said, I just love looking out there at the beauty. What's the most beautiful thing you've ever seen in the entire history of you looking in through telescopes?
Oh, well, I think my first time seeing Saturn, like most people, was just mind-blowing. You know, like that's not a sticker on a telescope. That's real.
Yeah.
But I think I'm very astonished by the nebulas, mostly because they're pretty colors. And, you know, that's where stars are being born and our universe began in these just clouds of gas and dust. And they are so simple, and yet they form such complicated things like our planets and our people.
I mean, we've seen the Horsehead Nebula and the Crab Nebula and everything. Why are they so simple? They don't seem so simple to me.
Well, they're just hydrogen and helium. That's it. And I mean, once you start to understand how they interact, they get much more complicated. There's turbulence, magnetic fields, you know, all this stuff in there. But just they're two atoms for the most part. You know, that's all these clouds are made of. And once you pack those atoms down, you can build a star, which creates fusion, which makes more atoms. And it has this whole trickle-down effect to everything more complicated we see in the universe. But it all started with hydrogen and helium. That's it. That's where we came from.
And the star nurseries are really something to see, yeah?
They are. I think that they're a lot of fun. I mean, that's why I studied them, you know, in part for my thesis, is I thought it was cool to look for these baby stars and baby planets. But yeah, I think they're fascinating and they're beautiful. You know, the best Hubble pictures, in my opinion, are of the pretty nebula.
Now, you've looked through telescopes, and I think I've told you before that, you know, I'm challenged with telescopes. And mm-hmm. one of the things I always wanted to do was to find Saturn and finally see it. And I'm not, again, I can barely hit the moon with a telescope.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at some of these distant galaxies, are you seeing color? Or are all the images that we see from Hubble and everything else, are they false color images?
Right. So with a small backyard telescope, you are primarily going to see black and white because you're not getting enough photons for your eyes to be able to perceive the colors. You know, we get, you know, gazillion more photons in this room than we ever do from a galaxy looking through a telescope. So we don't see the color. But Hubble and other telescopes are seeing the color through filters. And in many cases, with the Hubble in particular, it's looking at visible light. So often the reds that you see truly are red and the blues truly are blue. We can enhance them with the computer, but many times those are real. Not always, but a lot of times, at least for Hubble, the colors are real.
We're joined today by Valerie Rapson. The number is 800-348-2551. Astronomy Today on Vox Pop. Pat is in Middleburg. Pat, you're on.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
When I hear you talking about the universe expanding and what kind of energy is driving that, it puts me in mind to wonder, do you think there might be another universe or some kind of collection of entities out there beyond what we know of as our universe?
Something
out further?
Well, it's definitely a possibility. I mean, a lot of people are looking at the multiverse theory, you know, the idea that we are just one of many universes out there. And it sure does make us wonder, right, if there's something beyond what we can see. And we know that there's stuff beyond our visible universe that, unfortunately, we're never going to be able to see due to the limits of the speed of light. But it's definitely possible that there's another universe out there. We don't have any strong evidence for it, but it's not without the or beyond the realm of possibility.
Now, we've heard eminent physicists say, oh, yeah, well, string theory explains it all.
Mm-hmm.
And extra universes and extra dimensions explain it all.
Right.
But how are any of these things testable and provable?
That is the hard part, right? Once we have the mathematics to fully explain string theory, then I think we have to go look for visible evidence of other dimensions. And I'm not quite sure we know what that visible evidence is until we understand those other dimensions. So I don't know that I have a good answer for you yet of what could we look for to understand that there's 12 dimensions. I don't know. I think we have to, you know, use the mathematics and trust that and see if it'll build us something that is observable in our dimension that tells us that, you know, 12 others are out there.
Pat, you want to follow up?
No, that's a good answer. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the call. 800-348-2551 is our number. If you would like to try to stump Valerie Rapson here on the program, the Voyager bottle.
Yes.
Just makes me think about Voyager, which
uh-huh.
is now beyond the heliopause. It's
yes.
way out there.
Mm-hmm.
How far away is it at this moment?
Oh, man. I don't know the number off the top of my head. But, you know, we're talking like, I don't know, Pluto's at 40 AU and it's way beyond that. So it's got to be, you know, pushing 100 AU or something like that. I'd have to look it up, but it's far.
And it's still sending little tiny packets
little
of data.
Beeps. Yep.
And I mean, literally, it makes one of those old dial-up modems seem
robust. Yeah, well, it
robust.
Was, what, 77, I think they were launched. So, yeah, it's of that era.
But
so.
What can you learn if it's only sending you just a little bit of info from nothingness in the middle
right,
of nowhere?
Right, well, you're learning about interstellar space. If there are any fields or dust particles out there or things that are interacting in any way with the electronics, that is the information that you glean. So this is our first chance at learning more about interstellar space, first time we've been there.
And what is the nearest star?
The Proxima Centauri system at about 4 light years away.
And, you know, I was watching, I watch a lot of the Science Channel, History and Science Channel, That's what we watch, much to the chagrin of my entire family, who would much rather watch something else.
Yeah.
How long, if we were going half the speed of light, how long would it take us to get to Alpha Proxima?
Right. Well, so if you're going at the speed of light, it would take you 4 years to get there.
Right.
So if you're going at half the speed of light, take double the time, assuming that, you know, you can instantly go that fast. You know, you got to account for the acceleration.
So we're talking about 8 years.
Yeah. Yeah. We're talking about 8 years, give or take.
I wonder how long it'll be before we can get something that goes 1/20th or 1/30th.
Right. Well, you know, going fast is not a problem. It's accelerating to that speed that's the problem, because it's the acceleration that kills you. It's not the speed.
Right.
You know, you can go 60 miles an hour down the highway and it doesn't feel like you're going 60 or 100. You can't tell the difference inside the car. But when you slam on that gas pedal, you sure feel the difference. So that's what we have to overcome. And also, I'm very concerned about all the little particles that are flying through the universe, because when they come flying at you at half the speed of light, you know, that's when they become really dangerous.
Yeah, you know, and that's a real thing that I think about, too. Another one of those things I worry about is all of these space entrepreneurs who are sending soon will be in the next month. They're going to be going up there to suborbital flight. There is a real possibility of a disaster at some point. I mean, if you send a thousand jets up in the air, one of them is going to have some problems.
Right. Unfortunately, you know, there's always an issue. We make it look easy now. We're landing stuff on Mars. We're entering interstellar space, and it all feels easy, but there's problems all the time. I think one of the latest supply missions to the space station didn't make it.
Yeah.
That exploded just a couple days ago, I think. So, you know, problems still happen, and we need to be cautious and concerned about that.
Valerie Rapson joins us. Let's grab a call or two before we wrap it up here. Leo and Gardner. Leo, you're on.
Hi. Just a little while ago, you were talking about other universes, and I was listening to some astronomer friends, and apparently where the background radiation is very weak, they are thinking that they are possibly seeing other universes through this weak spot in the background radiation.
Well, I mean this gets to my point, Leo, to some extent. They're possibly seeing that. How do you prove that?
Right.
That's my question.
Right. Yeah, we have theories that explain, you know, those thin spots and those condensed spots, you know, that shows just our universe. But there are other theories out there, and that could be evidence for other universes. But we don't know for sure yet. We can't prove it.
True.
Right. I hate to be a bummer, but, you know.
Yeah. Well, Leo, thanks a lot.
Yeah, sure enough.
Take it easy. 800-348-2551. Valerie Rapson, if I look out in the sky now, I see just after sundown a very bright star to the north, maybe northwest. I don't know. It's got to be a planet.
Yeah, it's got to be Venus. You know, if you're seeing most things that rival the stars, it's usually Venus. And Venus should be in about that spot right now. Right after sunset, it's got to be really close to the horizon.
And it's very low, and then it's gone.
Yep. That's probably Venus. And if you stay up a little later, you can catch Jupiter and Saturn rising in the other direction.
Oh, very cool.
So
what time is that at night?
I think about, by 11 o'clock or so. They're at least, I think Saturn is up first, if I remember correctly.
That is well past my bedtime.
I know. But it's summer and it's warm. Just go camping and lay out all night.
It has been so brutally humid. I don't even want to step outside of the house, but I get your point.
Yeah.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. We only have 1 minute here.
Ooh.
So I see about three or four people on the line. We'll try to grab one, and we'll go to Alan in Palatine Bridge. Alan, you got 30 seconds, buddy. Hello, Alan. Well,
hello.
You got about 20 seconds here. Go ahead.
Hi.
Yeah.
Is there any time for a final question?
Well, there was, but go ahead. Yeah, try it.
Is there a telescope that is actually capable of seeing the lunar landers that have landed on the moon before?
Love this question.
Right. Not from Earth. We can do it from satellites that are orbiting the moon, but not from any telescopes that exist here on Earth.
And do we have pictures of that?
Oh, yes. Yeah, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. You can look it up. Beautiful pictures.
There you go. Well, that's it. That's where we will leave it. Alan, thanks a lot, and thanks to Valerie Rapson. So, You'll find out from the folks in Hollywood that, soon.
Soon, yes. And then, so maybe by the next show, we can let everybody know.
This is pretty exciting stuff. And meantime, you'll go back to Oneonta, and you'll possibly look for more of these supernova deals.
Mm-hmm. My students are going to make some awesome discoveries. We've got public planetarium shows coming up. Check our website for more information.
What is that website?
SUNY Oneonta's website. Look up Science Discovery Center. You'll see the planetarium info.
Valerie, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. This was awesome.
Support comes from Foresight Land Services for over 50 years, offering civil engineering, land surveying, planning, and environmental permitting to private and municipal clients in the Berkshires and eastern New York. ForesightLand.com. And SunCommon, building communities across New York for over 15 years, offering custom solar installations for homes, farms, and businesses, as well as the solar canopy and Tesla Powerwall. SunCommonSolar.com for details. Once again, thanks to Valerie Rapson for joining us today. Thank you for listening. Thank you for the calls. Thank you for the emails. Thank you to Zachary Malloy, our engineer. Phones answered today by WAMC business big shot Jordan Yuxall. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on Food Friday, Chef Gail Sokol will join us and try to teach me how to bake. This can only end badly. Join us tomorrow at 2. Right now, stand by for the Capital Connection.